United States blames Iran for supporting much of the violence in Iraq, and Iran says that the United States has brought its problems on itself. Still, earlier today, representatives from the two countries sat down to discuss the situation in Iraq for the second time this year. Joining me now for an analysis of this curious and complex relationship is Peter David, the foreign editor of The Economist. He edited a special section about Iran that appears in the current issue of the magazine, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to this month's Backstory. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for inviting me onto your show.
Has there been any news from today's negotiations?
Yes, so there has been news, and I think basically what's coming out is quite encouraging. The news is that instead of having just these occasional high-level contacts and nothing else, after this second meeting between Iranian diplomats and American diplomats, there will in future be a working group that is going to be set up to look in a less high-profile way at some of the issues that the two countries are discussing in Iraq.
So the American delegation didn't start off taking a hard line as was predicted?
Well, I understand that there was some there was some hard language. I mean, as you know, the Americans are adamant that the Iranians are up to no good in Iraq, and indeed are helping to organize some of the attacks on American forces in the country. And for their part, the Iranians are furious about the seizure by the Americans of five Iranian people inside Iraq, whom the Iranians say were simply diplomats going about their work, but whom the Americans accuse of having been Revolutionary Guards plotting attacks on the United States.
But if both sides come into negotiations with hard-line positions, is that the best way to negotiate anything?
Well, that's what negotiation is like, whether you're trying to organize the purchase of a house or whether you're trying to organize the reconciliation of two countries who've really despised each other to some degree since the Iranian Revolution of 1979.
But it reminds me of that that political cartoon from World War II where Hitler and Stalin meet, and I can't remember what they call each other, but it's awful names. I could just see the Iranians saying, "Oh, welcome to our negotiations, oh great Satan," and the American representative saying, "Yes, it's I've always wanted to talk to a member of the Axis of Evil."
Yeah, this isn't the way I would choose to design the world, but let's put it in some context that these are the first formal direct negotiations between American and Iranian diplomats since 1979.
So, I mean, nearly 30 years.
Yeah, that in itself has to be quite a good thing. It's good that this taboo has been broken and that a line has been crossed. Obviously, this is only the first step in what would have to be a much longer journey if there's going to be any real meeting of minds between America and Iran. But at least it's a start.
And what led to that? Is this something that happened because of a request from the Iraqi government?
Well, I think the Iraqis have been putting some pressure on both sides. I mean, the Iraqis are in a very unenviable position in many ways, but one of the things that makes their predicament so awful is that they have this huge neighbor, Iran, which has a lot of influence inside Iraq and which will always be their neighbor even after the United States goes home from Iraq. So they have to have good relations with Iran. But on the other hand, the Iraqi government is also completely dependent for the moment on the presence of the United States and its forces to keep some kind of lid on the violence there. So to have these two important countries at loggerheads with one another is very unpleasant for the government of Iraq.
But isn't it assumed, ultimately, after the United States leaves, that Iran will be the most the real winner in this whole thing because it is the Shiite neighbor to a Shiite majority country, Iraq?
Well, it is assumed, but to my mind, it shouldn't be so assumed. And that's because the fact that both countries are majority Shiite countries doesn't really, to my mind, tell you very much about what their future relations are going to be like. I mean, for a start, there was a very long war between the two countries, 8 years long, which cost at least 1 million lives. And during that war, the Arab identity of the Iraqi Shias seemed very strong. In other words, they actually did see themselves as Arabs fighting a Persian foe rather than as co-religionists. Iran and Iraq are historical rivals. And I think, I'm not predicting that there will be another war between them, but I think any idea that the Iranians have that they're just going to control Iraq is probably an illusion. The Iraqis will want to assert their independence from Iran and are in a position to do it in the long run.
What was the outcome of the first round of negotiations in May?
Just an exchange of insults and an agreement to meet again.
Well, that's a good way to lower expectations, isn't it?
Yes, I don't want to make huge claims for this. As I said, it's a symbolic first step. It could lead on to some practical agreements inside Iraq. But, of course, on the agenda, there ought to be much bigger questions relating to relations between America and Iran, which so far no one is, neither side is willing to address. There is the question of Iran's nuclear program, primarily. The fact that the Americans and many other countries believe that Iran is producing nuclear weapons is going to lead to some sort of crisis and showdown at some point, I believe. And it would be much better if Iran and the United States could start talking openly about that. And then there is Iran's policy in Lebanon, where it is supporting the Hezbollah organization, and the United States is supporting the other side, the so-called March 14th forces in Lebanon. And lastly, there is the question of Israel. Iran is very hostile to Israel. It supports the rejectionists in the Palestinian camp. So there are many things that the United States and Iran need to discuss, and so far all they're doing is beginning to discuss one of those, which is what to do in Iraq.
My guest is Peter David, the foreign editor of The Economist. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, a segment of Backstory. Iraq is an important thing to discuss because the United States can't realistically hope to end the violence in Iraq without cooperation from Iran. Isn't that true?
I think Iraq is, something that is very important to discuss. I'm not denying that. And I don't think anyone, to be honest, neither the Iraqis nor the Americans nor the Iranians, have it within their power to subdue the Sunni insurgency anytime soon or to prevent the internecine strife between Sunnis and Shias in Iraq. The most that all these countries can do is try to collaborate at some elementary level to prevent things getting much worse. However, I would submit that America and Iran have got some shared interests. I mean, neither of them really wants to see the complete collapse of Iraq. The Americans certainly don't want to see that. And the Iranians don't want a neighbor that is splintering into little statelets and independent countries, not least because one of them would be the Kurdish area in the north of Iraq, which, if it became independent, might have a destabilizing effect on Iran's own Kurdish population. So there is some shared interest between Iran and the United States in this region.
The United States has been accusing Iran of supplying the insurgents and others with arms and making a kind of a weapons of mass destruction case, which has been met with a certain amount of suspicion. Has the Bush administration ever provided any solid evidence of Iran actually sending in arms as a matter of governmental policy?
I haven't seen evidence that is conclusive. The claims that the United States has made have been questioned by knowledgeable observers and independent sources. But I must say, I would be surprised if Iran wasn't helping some of the groups inside Iraq in a military way.
Because it has a similar policy of supplying Hezbollah in Lebanon, you say, and to some degree Hamas in the Palestinian territory as well.
Well, that's correct. And Iran is very close to some particular militias inside Iraq. For example, Muqtada al-Sadr's Mahdi army has got particularly close relations with Tehran. And probably, and this is just surmise, I don't have any hard and fast evidence to produce, but probably Muqtada al-Sadr sees Iran as a source of military advice and support and receives some of that.
But I'm assuming also Iran will continue to deny any support unless the United States presents concrete evidence.
I'm sure they will continue to deny it. I mean, the official Iranian line is that Iran is an innocent observer of what's going on inside Iraq, that the Americas are the occupiers, and that the American invasion brought the country into its present very bad path. So when I was in Tehran researching my report for The Economist, I encountered vehement arguments that Iran was simply doing its best to ameliorate a situation which the Americans had had created.
But hasn't Iran also complicated the situation by detaining two Iranian-American scholars since May? Last week they appeared on Iranian state television. What did they say?
Well, this is really a pretty scandalous story, in my view. I mean, there's no question at all in the minds of anyone who knows about these scholars that they are innocent scholars, openly going about their normal business in Iran. They have done everything in the open with full transparency. In the case of one of the people who's been arrested, Hala Esfandiari, she was visiting her 90-plus-year-old mother, who's ill in Tehran. And then she was detained, and now she stands accused of trying to foment a so-called velvet revolution in the country.
Well, should we see this as being part of the timing before negotiations begin?
No, I don't think it's really tied to these negotiations that took place yesterday. I think this is part of something a little different. This is part of a general crackdown inside Iran by a regime that feels itself threatened by international sanctions and which is trying to exploit the feeling of beleaguerment and encirclement by crushing the opposition. And I think by arresting these American scholars, it is sending a strong signal to internal would-be dissidents that they'd better not cross the line. As a matter of fact, there was a much more for Iran significant arrest recently, which was the arrest by the authorities of a former nuclear negotiator for Iran, a real regime insider who was grabbed and accused of being a spy. Subsequently, he was released, but it so happens that this man is identified closely with the opposition, the legal formal opposition in Iran. And his arrest and the outlandish charge that was made against him is, I think, just a sign that the regime is cracking down and sending a signal to anyone who's critical of what it's doing, that they'd better take a great deal of care in future.
How do you read the members of the British Navy who were held by the Iranian government earlier this year and then released? What did Iran gain by detaining them?
Well, that's still shrouded in a lot of controversy. Here in London, we don't see that as the proudest moment of the Royal Navy. But I guess that one of the most plausible explanations is that it was a reaction to the arrest I mentioned earlier of five Iranians inside Iraq by the United States. Had the Iranians taken their revenge directly against American sailors, I think that would have been extremely risky for them. That wasn't a danger they were willing to face. But the British, who are in a much weaker position in the Persian Gulf with far less independent force or ability to maneuver or take action, we're a sort of juicy target, and the regime, I think, felt it sent a message that if you mess with us, we'll mess with you.
British Prime Minister Gordon Brown will be coming to Washington next week to meet with President Bush. Iran is expected to be on the agenda, and I'm sure Iraq as well. Do you see any possibility of real change now that Tony Blair is no longer the prime minister?
Certainly not on the Iran issue. Interestingly enough, at a press conference in Downing Street yesterday, Gordon Brown was asked whether he would rule out the possibility of a preemptive military attack at some point in the future on Iran's nuclear sites. And he very clearly said that he was not prepared to rule that out. Now, that's quite a strong message for two reasons. One is that a previous British Foreign Secretary who worked for Tony Blair, Jack Straw, had once called the idea of a military attack on Iran crazy. So Gordon Brown is, first of all, distancing himself very clearly from that position. And the second reason that what Gordon Brown said yesterday is significant is that many people in Britain thought that it would be clever for the new prime minister to show that he was some people would say here, slavish ally of the United States by distancing himself from American policy on some such issue. But in fact, he's got a hard line on Iran, and Britain is in fact trying right now to organize a new resolution in the Security Council that would impose sharper sanctions on Iran until it complies with its nuclear obligations. So I think the message from Gordon Brown so far is that he's quite tough on the Iran issue.
Why had Jack Straw said that a preemptive strike would be crazy?
Well, in this country, the war in Iraq has come to be extremely unpopular. And connected
in this country as well.
Indeed. But we have an extra complication, which is that people feel that Tony Blair, who I know is still quite strongly admired in the United States, but people here felt that he had identified himself much too closely with George Bush's foreign policy in general and with Iraq in particular. And that had become a liability for him politically in Britain. He never apologized for that, but many people felt that when he left office and Gordon Brown took over, that in order to secure his own re-election when the time comes, that Gordon Brown would put more distance between Britain and the United States. Well, so far he's been careful not to do that.
Peter David is my guest on today's Backstory, talking about relations between the United States and Iran. He is the foreign editor of The Economist and edited a special section about Iran that appears in the current issue of The Economist. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Peter David, the foreign editor of The Economist, talking on Backstory today about U.S.-Iranian relations. And whenever we talk about it in this country, we tend to look back to when the Ayatollah Khomeini came to power and the seizing of the U.S. Embassy. But in speaking with Iranians, I always hear that the grievances go back a lot further, that many are still upset by the U.S. intervention that overthrew Mossadegh's government in 1953. Do you see that as a starting point, or does it go back even earlier than that?
Well, I think what is certainly true is that if you fall into conversation with the average Iranian and talk about history, that Iran sees itself as a country that has been interfered with a lot by outsiders. And to be frank, they're right. I mean, that's true. It's not, oddly enough, it's the British also get it in the neck a lot in Iran. The British were the main influence in Iran for much of the 19th and 20th century. And even to this day, you hear people in Iran complain that, you know, behind the United States, the British are manipulating events to exploit Iran. One of the funniest things that one always hears in Iran from people who oppose the current regime there is that the British organized Ayatollah Khomeini's revolution as a way of getting their revenge against the United States for becoming top power. So there is no end to Iranian grievances. But yes, to get to your question, the CIA did engineer a coup in 1953 that removed a popular elected prime minister, Mossadegh, and it reinstalled the Shah, and that is something which people are strongly resentful about to this day.
Although Mossadegh's policies would have been far to the left of President Ahmadinejad's, Mossadegh was a nationalist, and Ahmadinejad is a religiously based regime, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think, the irony is that I think most Iranians see the regime they have got at the moment as a more legitimate government than the one that the Shah represented. I mean, the Shah was seen as someone who was supported in power by foreign countries, and his regime was very repressive and tried to marginalize Islam, which is obviously not a good policy in a country like Iran. So, the Shah is still disliked, but that hasn't prevented over the past nearly 30 years the new regime, the regime of the Ayatollahs, from becoming quite resented and unpopular in its turn. And when you travel in Iran, you do see very clear signs of the unpopularity of clerical rule.
Well, has that translated into a little more positive feeling about the United States?
Well, it's a very peculiar thing. You know, we just talked a second ago about how Iranians have a sense of historical grievance against the United States.
And then there's the Iran-Iraq War, where the United States gave tactical support to Saddam Hussein.
Yes, it did. But on the other hand, the United States is a country which many young Iranians seem to admire. Indeed, I mean, many young Iranians would dearly love to be able to emigrate to the United States. American culture and fashion and values and habits are admired by young Iranians. I think it's a case of when your government tries to suppress something, you try to go in the opposite direction, particularly if you're young. And you see some of that in Iran. I mean, here is a regime which is quite repressive, very traditional, austere, makes women wear the hijab, doesn't allow young couples to caress each other in public places. Basically, it's a sort of killjoy regime, and also not a very competent one when it comes to running the economy. So the natural reaction of people is to do the forbidden thing and flirt with the idea of being more like America.
Actually, I just heard they've reinstituted death for adultery, the death sentence for adultery. But the United States has had a hardline policy in connection to North Korea. Recently, we have negotiated the shutdown of its nuclear reactor. Do you think that Iran has been isolated, or do you think that we can learn something from what we've done with North Korea and apply it to this last member of the axis of evil?
I'm not so sure that we should be so encouraged by what has just happened in North Korea, or that there are any good lessons in it. When we were discussing the North Korea story at The Economist last week, someone suggested we should put the headline on it, North Korea bolts the stable door, or locks the stable door, because the fact is the nuclear horses have bolted. I mean, North Korea has shut down its reactor, but it still has nuclear weapons. It hasn't given them up yet. So I don't see what's happened in North Korea as a model to be followed. I do think we really need to do something pretty soon that is more effective in persuading Iran not to go down the route of acquiring nuclear weapons, because if it gets closer to having a bomb, I think there is a real probability that either the United States or Israel will launch a military attack on Iran, and that would have terrible consequences. So,
and Gordon Brown says he might do it as well, you just said.
Well, he certainly isn't taking that threat off the table. I don't think Britain would do it itself, but what he was signaling is that if the Americans did it, Britain would not necessarily disapprove.
Well, is that really possible? Could the United States really afford to launch a second military attack in the region? And wouldn't that completely destabilize the entire Middle East?
I think it's, I think it's true that it would destabilize the Middle East, and it would have very bad consequences, but that doesn't mean it might not happen. I mean, if you were to put yourself in the position of policymakers, when they look at this, they would, of course, tell themselves that they're not talking about another invasion, as in the case of Iraq. There's no question of the United States invading Iran. I mean, the country is simply much too big and too populous. All that's being considered is a series of airstrikes against particular nuclear sites.
With hope that our intelligence is accurate.
Yeah, well, I mean, the track record on that isn't so great. So yes, there are many reasons why I personally think this would be a very bad path to go down. Not least because even if an airstrike on Iran were successful or moderately successful and did manage to cripple the Iranian nuclear program, at least for a while, there's no doubt in my mind that the Iranians would strike back, and I think they have the wherewithal. They could do extremely disruptive things. They could step up whatever it is they're doing against American forces in Iraq and then on another of their borders in Afghanistan. They could fire long-range missiles, which they have plenty of, at Israel. They could organize terrorism around the world, which they have done in the past through proxies like Hezbollah. They could disrupt the oil supplies through the Strait of Hormuz quite easily, which would have a devastating effect on world oil prices. So we would be in the midst of a really ghastly crisis. And although some people, including many of the current presidential candidates, say it's worth running that risk to prevent Iran from getting hold of nuclear weapons, I'm not persuaded. I think it may well be that it would be better, though undesirable, for Iran to end up with nuclear weapons, because I think it could probably be deterred, as many nuclear powers have been before it, from ever using those weapons.
My guest is Peter David, the foreign editor of The Economist. But you just mentioned the presidential candidates. In last night's Democratic debate, Barack Obama said that he would engage Iran in face-to-face talks. Hillary Clinton was more wary, and she didn't want to. She said she didn't want to be used for propaganda purposes. But I think most people assume that there will be a change in tactics, no matter who becomes the next president. And I guess the question is Iran willing to wait to see what happens? They did in the past. Would George Bush be impatient and try to force the issue before he left office?
Well, as you know, opinions on this are very divided. There's surely some little bit of George Bush's thinking, which says, I put the prevention of nuclear proliferation right at the top of my foreign policy quite early on in the life of my administration. I listed the countries of the axis of evil. I included Iran. And I must make sure before I leave office that I sort this problem out, or history will judge me harshly. So I'm sure that is part of the calculation he will be making about his responsibilities and his legacy. And for sure, that seems to be the sort of advice that he's getting from Dick Cheney. So, you know, there is that possibility. I mean, I can't put it more strongly than that, any stronger than that. We're only dealing with possibilities and probabilities, not with any certainties in this situation.
Is there any possibility of regime change in Iran? You talked about dissatisfaction. There's high unemployment and inflation. The economy has really been mishandled. And it looked for a time under Khatami that the country was going to really liberalize. Instead, we've seen it move in another direction, but that must be leading to more and more dissatisfaction.
My judgment is that we won't see regime change of the sort that's brought about by some popular violent or non-violent uprising. We won't see a velvet revolution in Iran. There doesn't seem to be much of an organized opposition. But more to the point, there doesn't seem to be a feeling amongst Iranians at large that their government is illegitimate. They don't like its policies. They are very upset about rising inflation, about the level of unemployment, about some of the petty rules which are imposed on their lives by the clerics who run the place. But by and large, they seem to regard the regime as a regime which, even if it makes mistakes, has got a right to be in charge. They see it as their legitimate government. So I think when Iran changes, and I'm sure it will change, it will be more in the style of the Soviet Union, that there will be change from inside the regime. There will be people eventually admitting that a country as big and complicated as Iran is can't be run by the clerical system that has existed since the revolution. And we'll begin to see modernization, more pluralism, more democracy, more civil liberties. But it will be a gradual and difficult process. There won't be a sudden change of regime as a result of demonstrations on the street or anything of that sort. I ought to say that everyone always gets Iran wrong. I mean, people might remember that Jimmy Carter called Iran an island of stability in a volatile region just a couple of months before the revolution that overthrew the Shah. So any predictions about Iran have to come with a health warning attached.
In March, the UN Security Council passed a second resolution demanding that Iran stop enriching uranium. Iran just seems to be blowing off those kinds of things. Is there any chance that those resolutions will have an effect?
I think the best hope is for a sharper resolution. I mean, a new resolution with sharper sanctions. But it has to be, this goes back to the beginning of our discussion, the sanctions, the punishment, have to be matched by a big, juicy carrot which the world can dangle in front of Iran, so that if the regime changes its mind on the nuclear issue, it can at least turn around to its people and say, hey, look, we've got a real achievement here. You know, we may have given up some aspects of our nuclear program, but instead of that, we have something we can show you that's a great triumph. And in my view, that something could be a historic reconciliation with the United States, so that the regime could say to its people, we have finally talked to the Americans into accepting the legitimacy of our regime and the right of our country to play a leading role in the Middle East region. You know, that if some such grand bargain, as they call it, of that kind could be offered to the Iranians at the same time as some economic pressure was applied to them, I think there is at least a chance that the regime will change its policies.
Well, if there is any hope for stability in the area in the future in Iraq, isn't something like that going to have to happen?
It's always easy to say that something is going to have to happen, but unfortunately that something often just doesn't happen. There is, of course, the precedent of Nixon to China. I mean, the reconciliation and the opening up between China and the United States came about partly because the Americans were trying to extricate themselves from a war that was failing. And so it may well be that wise policy in the future will pull America out of Iraq in the context of some agreement with the Iranians to stabilize the region. That would be a very good outcome from a very unhappy war.
Do you see anybody proposing anything that might succeed? The French? Obviously, Gordon Brown is not.
I don't think there are mediators here. I mean, the Europeans have already offered all kinds of incentives to Iran, but the Iranian fixation is on the United States. And nothing is credible to them unless the address they're dealing with is America. So I don't think middle parties are going to do much. I think it all depends on decisions that are made in Tehran and Washington.
Thank you so much, Peter David of The Economist. It's been a real pleasure talking to you today on Backstory.
Many thanks. Bye.